This is a recording of Functional Programming Brno Meetup number 5, where John Berg talks about types and higher groupoids. Functional Programming Brno is a platform for everyone with interest in functional programming that happens to be in or near Brno. To find out more, visit fpbrno.github.io.
So, want to start?
Well, yes, this is about types and higher groupoids and some sort of connections that have been started to be made in the last 10 years or so between functional programming languages, some areas of or Martin Loaf type theory, which is intentional type theory, and higher category theory, or higher groupoids, which are these sort of exotic structures that people have been trying to understand since about the 1960s. They're really hard to basically just give a definition of, because they involve infinite amounts of data and axioms and so on. They're not sort of finitely axiomatizable. So people have been struggling to find them for about 20 or 30 years, say. So I'm not actually going to give a formal definition of an infinity groupoid today, but I'll try and give the idea and show how you can construct one from a type in Martin Loaf type theory, or start the construction. But I'll be coming from a sort of historical viewpoint where these higher groupoids, so first of all, groupoids were of interest, then higher groupoids, what are groupoids, what are higher groupoids? What are the natural examples of these structures, coming from a mathematical background, which is all about spaces rather than types, algebraic topology and all this stuff. So what are the examples? And finally, from Martin Loaf type theory. So I'll discuss that a little bit, if I manage to do all this, because I'm not really assuming that you all know any or have studied mathematics in a sort of university setting or whatever. So I want to get to define a groupoid to begin with. But before I define a groupoid, I guess I should talk about something, a special case of categories and groupoids, or monoids and groups. So I feel like people who've studied computer science and stuff have seen what a monoid is. But here's what it is. So a monoid consists of, so we're going to start with a monoid. So a monoid consists of a set X, an operation, this is little x, which takes a pair of elements. So I'm writing in this sort of type theoretic notation just to, I don't know if it'll make you feel comfortable or what it'll make you feel, but it seemed like an appropriate thing to do. So from each pair of elements of x, we can construct a new element. So we have a binary operation, and we have a unit element, and these are supposed to satisfy a few laws, the best known of which would be the associative law, which says that it doesn't matter in which way. So if you're given a string of elements or a word of elements, there's only one way really to multiply them up. So that's the generating axiom. So that's the associative law. And then you have unit laws as well. So we've got the unit laws say that this E behaves like a unit. So when you multiply it by anything on the left or on the right, you get that. And likewise, if you multiply it on the other side, so examples. So this is close. Does everybody know what a monoid is? And so on. So this is good. Maybe I'll go through some of these examples quickly then. So the most basic example of a monoid is just the natural numbers. So the positive integers, or 0, 1, 2, 3, etc., with addition, so it's associative, okay? And unit is 0. So when you add 0 to something, you get the same thing. Another important example is, you have a set, you can look at finite lists in it, okay, so you can think of this as an alphabet set. So then the multiplication, the binary operation is concatenation, which just sticks two lists together side by side. And its unit is the emptiness. So for example, ABC multiplied by DGD. So another example would be the set of functions from a set to itself. That makes sense. So you can you can compose functions on the identity function. Okay, so does that make sense? If you've got function f from x to x and a function g from x to x, then you can first do f and then do g. So that's a few examples of monoids. So we're trying to go from monoids to categories and from things called groups to groupoid. So what is a group is the next thing. Groups were one of the first things to be defined in a sort of axiomatic way as some general class structures. But these are just monoids with inverses. So that means that we have from an element x of x, you're given another element called its it's inverse, and this has to satisfy some laws as well. Well, the expected ones. Right, so a few more trivial examples. Well, not trivial, very important examples, but ones I guess everybody knows. Now we could take the integers, positive and negative, with addition and zero. So now every element has its inverse is minus that element. So, okay. So we can try and modify some of our other examples. So let's modify the functions one. So instead of looking at all functions from x to x, you could look at, so you might not know the term bijection, but it's just a function which is in which, do people know what a bijection is? Yeah, everybody knows this sort of stuff. Okay. All right. So these aren't really the examples of groups that will lead, well, from type theory, maybe they're not so far away, but the historical motivation for groupoids and higher groupoids to some extent, or one avenue that led to these higher groupoids comes from spaces like the circle or spheres and so on. Then you have things called homotopy groups, which are higher dimensional things, higher dimensional versions of the what's called a fundamental group. And this is more in line with the sort of direction in which we'll be coming to groupoids and higher groupoids. I just mentioned that one because it's a nice fact that the higher homotopy groups were introduced by Edward Czech in 1932, when he was at Massey Mac University, in fact. So, that we may have written, it's a funny story, to find these things called the higher homotopy groups, but another famous topologist showed that they had a property called being commutative, which were abelian groups, and Edward Czech didn't expect this. He thought it sort of trivialized the whole theory, because they were supposed to be non-abelian analogues of some abelian thing. So Edward Czech didn't publish his results and just abandoned the whole thing. But later it turned out that our fundamental structures of study in a subject called topology, which is just about spaces. But everybody knows that Edward Czech was the one who first defined them. All right, so that's monoids and groups. So now we're going to go towards categories and groupoids, which are generalized monoids and generalized groups. So a category is like a monoid with many objects. So you can make that formal. So what's the definition? It's right, a category, as a set. If anyone's confused at any point, feel free to stop me as well. Right, because I might use some inconsistent notation and stuff as well. So you've got a set of things called objects in a category.
That's a collection.
Okay. Collection of things. Good. so I'm trying to write it, or you can think of it as a type of things. Right, so I'm given a pair of objects, we're given from them a set, an abstract set. So from a pair of objects, we have a set just given to us, which, and we can think of these as morphisms. Right, so you think of the elements of this given set as morphisms from X to Y, or functions from X to Y, or whatever, okay? I mean, I'm writing with this silly type theoretic notation. It's supposed to be just because this is an example of a dependent type kind of, we'll be looking at that a little bit later. And so I thought I'd stick to this. But basically, categories have just got objects, and between the objects, we've got morphisms, okay? And so we've got composition. Again, we've got composition and identities, like in the monoid case. So composition says that if you're given a morphism f from x to y, so an element of this set, and a morphism g from y to z, then you are given, well, I could use this sort of notation again. We've got a morphism from X to Z. So we have identities on each object. So if you've got an object, then you have an identity morphism on that. Okay? And now we have the associative laws and the unit laws, again, like in the model. So the associative law says that, hopefully, again, if I write sort of, if my notation's a bit inconsistent in places and you're confused, say something, but this, I'm saying given the triple of things, given a triple of composable arrows, then we have that, there's two ways of getting an arrow from W to Z, right? So we can first compose H and G, and then compose them with F, or we can do it the other way, and the associative law for a category says that these are the same, okay? And then we have the unit laws, if you've got a morphism, F from X to Y, but then you can compose it with these identities on either side, so then, what can we do? we have our identity in X, and then we can compose that with F afterwards, and that should equal F. And likewise, we could have done F first and then composed it with the identity on Y. Okay. That equals F as well. So that's the definition of a category. Okay. So let's look at some examples. So the fundamental example of a category. So you take the objects are sets, just sets, okay? And the morphisms are the functions between them. And this composition of arrows is just composition of functions. And these identities are the identity function. So the function that just given a certain element returns the same element. Okay, so does that make sense that this is a category?
Yeah.
So have people seen categories before as well? Then?
Yes. Some people
won't. So category theory was developed because with this, basically mathematical structures always have a notion of morphism between them, something which preserves that structure. And mathematical structures like groups and the morphisms between them form categories. And you can study common areas, or you can study if you can prove something then about a category, you prove it about all sorts of different areas of maths at once, or then you study the relationships between different categories by morphisms of categories called functors and all this sort of stuff. So that's what category theory is about, and it's all intimately related to this, to spaces. And to spaces, for example, from space you can construct an algebraic structure called a group. So that's moving between two different categories, the category of space and the category of groups. And it was to understand such passages that category theory was introduced in the 40s. But so mathematical structures form categories. That's the start of the subject. Another example, so if C is a category, then and you pick an object X in C, then the set of morphisms from X to itself is a monad, right? Because given two elements of this thing, which are just morphisms from X to itself, you can compose them, right? So you get a monad. Conversely, every monoid gives rise to a category with a single object, see? Because if you have a monoid, like over here, so if X is a monoid, just pick, or just call pick a random object, dot, and the elements, defining the morphisms from dot to itself to the elements of the monoid, okay? And then you get composition in the monoid will give you composition in the associated category. So that's the slogan, categories are monoids with many objects. So you might have to think about that one a little bit. I'm not going to. But anyway, so that's monoids, categories, or monoids, groups, categories. So
question: can you think of a nice example of a category that has more than a single object in it, and isn't that one the obvious one?
Yeah. So that's
well, for illustration. Because I was expecting a second example, and you kind of hacked around that.
Well, okay, so there's millions of examples, big ones like that, which where you're looking at like sets with structure like monoids or groups, they all form categories. I guess that's probably you would like to see a smaller example, but with more than one object. So another example, every post-set is a category. So for example, if you just consider the list of natural numbers, that's an example of a category. There's only a unique morphism from stage one going down, so compositions, there's only one way to compose them, right? So that's an example of a category. So every ordering gives rise to a category. So like any little picture you can draw is a category. There's a category of two objects.
Okay. There's a lot of examples from computer science.
The things I would like to understand better actually is this business where you think of, the objects could be, say, propositions, and a morphism is supposed to be a proof that one implies construction, taking something first set type or to something second type, sort of like proofs or programs and stuff. That's the sort of direction in which functional programming and category theory and type theory and stuff are connected. But I guess we'll come towards that direction a bit more. All right, so that's monoids and groups, and then categories. So what's a groupoid? Yeah, so the notations, the terminology is a bit funny because a groupoid is like a group with many elements. So if we call a, so if a many element group is a groupoid, then surely we should call a many element monoid a monoidoid. But we don't. So categories is a many object. Monoids. Well, groupoids are in the same way, many object groups. Right. So a or I should say, so categories within versus. So a groupoid is a category. Well, how do we write it? So each morphism gives rise to another morphism point in the opposite direction, which will be its inverse, and this satisfies the inverse laws. This satisfies, well, we could do f to the minus 1 and then do f, and that should be equal to the identity on y, and likewise, if you do it in the other direction, so f to the minus 1, and that should equal the identity on x. Okay, so that's a groupoid. So what's an example of a groupoid? Sets on bijective functions, okay? So that's the many-object version of the example of bijective functions from a set to itself, where every group gives rise to a groupoid again. Or just for another small example of a groupoid, you could have, say, 0 and 1, and single r going that way, single r going that way, and define the compositions to be the identities of these two things. Okay, so that's just some examples. Okay, so that's, now we've done...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah?
Category theorists usually have some holistic view, which means that they can consider two objects being the same if they are isomorphic. And now, in groupoid, all objects are isomorphic. So
no.
No, any two connected objects,
connected objects are isomorphic. Right. Right. They can be disconnected as well.
Yeah, so here's another example of a groupoid, like in which there's nothing except identity morphisms. Right, so you've got the identity in A, identity in B, identity in C, but none of A, B, and C are connected. So none of them are isomorphic. But yeah, so groupoid theory it's kind of a trivialization. So category theory, it's where you, it's largely about constructing things, not finding out the characterizing properties of some complex constructions in a simple way that characterizes the things you construct up to isomorphism. So things like products, not giving the explicit construction of what the product is, but describing properties that characterize it. And because in the different categories, you won't have the same explicit construction. So you want to find what the characterizing properties of these things have. But of course, if everything's isomorphic, or if you're only looking... So all that sort of category theory becomes trivial if you're studying groupoids. Groupoids are different sort of structure. The examples are different in that sense. So you don't study products or limits in groupoids and stuff. In fact, every groupoid is like equivalent to just a disjoint union of groups. So people, you could say that's a reason to ignore, say, groupoids and just study groups. But anyway, but the reason category theory was developed, that sort of category theory you're mentioning, has nothing to do with groupoids, really, in the sense of groupoids as categories. But that was just a bit waffly. So the groupoid stuff really comes from topology and this kind of Edward Check business I mentioned about those sort of groups, like fundamental groups, and that's what I'm going to talk about now. So now we're going to go straight to infinity groupoids. And like I said, I'm not going to be able to give a precise definition. I will give a reference to a paper of mine, which is semi-expository, but part of the point there was to explain Grothendieck's definition of infinity groupoid as simply as possible. So if you know a bit of category theory, if you've seen things like Lovere theories, then you should be able to, if you ever heard of a Lovere theory, it's a categorical approach to universal algebra. But if you know about that, then you can understand Grothendieck's definition, I would say, of infinity groupoid. Though it would still be hard enough going, but I'll give some references. All right, infinity groupoids. So what I'm going to be trying to convey is more the intuition or the idea of what they are than the precise definition. And the motivation comes from studying paths in a space, which is what Edward Check was doing, and higher dimensional paths in a space. That's what Edward Check first defined in these higher homotopy groups, which will just come out of a higher groupoid in the same way as each category or each groupoid gives rise to a group by taking homomorphic or maps from an object to itself. Okay, I'll just get on with it. So I'm not even going to define what a space is. So those of you, who knows what a space is? Like, we'd say a topological space or whatever, but I mean things like geometric figures, like circles and spheres and so on. So given a space X, You can look, it has points, and what's that? So given points, given points A and B, we can consider paths between those points. Okay, so this is, I mean, this is what you think it is. Just draw a picture. So this can be our space X, okay? And here are a couple of points in it, and a path is just, say, a line from A to B. And here's another path. So it's a continuous path, okay? So you can't have, say, that is a non-continuous thing. Okay, so that's not a path. Okay, so formally, this is the way you define these things. We denote by the interval 0, 1, the space of all points, the continuous line between 0 and 1, okay? Then a path is defined as the image of such a thing, the continuous image of it. So that means we look at continuous functions. So you don't really need to know what continuous function means, except that it means what it's supposed to mean, that there's no gaps. It's harder to define it rigorously. But so a path is a continuous function from A to B. And it's a continuous function such that it starts at A. So f of 0 is A, and f of 1 equals B. Okay, so here you're thinking of this this interval as being time. All right, so this is the time from 0 to 1. And what you say, what you're thinking is that in the time from 0 to 1, you move from, at 0, you move from the point A over to the point.
So the domain of f is basically every point of the path.
you see, continuous maps more or less take things which look like that. Continuous is the images of the path. You can have sort of points going back in themselves because you didn't say it's sort of one to one or anything. But so, all right. So we can compose paths. Very intuitive thing. So what does that mean? So how do we compose our paths? So if you've got a path from A to B and a path from B to C, well, formally, we're supposed to be given a map from this, or this is supposed to go from time zero, t equals 0 to time t equals 1. Right, so what we can do is do them at twice the speed, right? So do at speed times 2. So if you write that down what that means as an equation, so we're doing that formally, it says, in the time between 0 and a half, then you're going to set gf of t to be equal to f of 2t, right? So let's say if you do it twice as fast, and then the time between a half and 1, that's when you do g, right? So in time 0 to a half, you do f, and time g, and that's the equation that makes that work. Okay, so then you'll see when t is equal to a half, you're going to get f of 1, which is equal to b, and you get g of 0, which is equal to b as well. So these things do match up as appropriate. And so that's a composition of paths, really the obvious way of doing it. We have sort of an identity path, right? So this is our constant path. So this would be, say, e of a. Well, this is just constant at a. And then we have sort of inverse paths, or reverse might be a better word, which says, so you go, that just says, given the path f from A to B, you can do it in the other direction. Okay, so the formula is f to the minus 1 of t is equal to f of 1 minus t, right? Because then when t is equal to 0, you'll get f of 1, so it goes the other way.
Wouldn't people sort of have more identities? I mean, wouldn't any loop be an identity?
No, so that's where, so here's the, okay, so any loop will give you a map from A to itself, say, mm-hmm. But it's, in fact, none of these things are identities, but the whole Edward Check thing I was talking about is about studying, is about the loop case when you're strict to the one object case, and that's, so here you could consider, for example, this space, and then you could look at a loop in there, and that sort of is the same as this constant one, because you can, like, you can squish this down, pull it like a string, continuously through the space until it was just the constant map. Just pull it through the space. But on the other hand, if you have this space where you have a hole cut out of the middle, okay, and here's another loop now around the hole, so we could have a point, and we could have the constant path on the point as well. that's got a very different character to this loop which goes once around the hole. Because you could try and turn one into the other by pulling it, but you can't pull it through the hole in space. So these paths and spaces are, I mean, originally the associated groups are designed to count holes in spaces. But anyway, so none of it's kind of confusing when I say identities and inverses, because the point is that this isn't a groupoid. So we can see that clearly already. Suppose you had a path from A to B, F, and then you compose it with the constant path on B, okay? Well, then I would say you do F in the time only to a half, and then after that you're constant, which isn't the same as F, right? Because F is, that's not what F does, but they are the same up to higher dimensional paths, up to two paths. So this is where the higher groupoid structure comes in. So what I'm saying is this is not a groupoid. There are laws for a groupoid, so the associated, all the laws, only up to higher paths, higher dimensional paths. So we can think of infinity groupoid as an attempt to capture the algebra of paths and higher dimensional paths in space.
What do we mean by higher paths?
So that's what I'll tell you now. Well, at least I'll tell you what a two-dimensional path is. Okay, so given paths. Alright, so I'm going to have to admit, if we're going to do the modern wave type theory stuff, I'm going to go a bit over time. Yeah, sorry. I didn't really know how long this was going to take. You've got a pair of paths in X, so a two path, and there will be n paths for all n. You can write it like this. This is the traditional notation sort of higher dimensional category theory, or just, or we might just write alpha from F to G, but that. Then you lose a bit of information to the objects. Well, it's a continuous, so intuitively, it's a continuous transformation. Of F into, I'll define it precisely in a second as well, of F into G. So example, so this is, so we can, let's consider what's called the disk. So the disk is the circle filled with all the points in between. So if we've got a pair of paths in here from A to B, well, we can continuously pull this path down until it becomes the other path and sort of fill it in like that. So again, thinking of moving through time, you can turn one path into the other one. You could physically do it starting at time zero and finish at time one. So that's what I mean by continuous transformation. Now, you could also look at the sort of band shape where you've got a hole in the middle. And now, if we look, we could look, so it's got a hole cut out. And now if we look at our pair of paths again, we can't just pull this down continuously through because you can't pull it through the hole. Okay? So here we've got, so if this is F, G, F, and G, this one, that's an example of, say, alpha from F to G, and in this case, there is no alpha from F to G, okay? So what you look at in these fundamental groups, actually, is you look at paths, but equivalence classes of paths up to these two-dimensional. So you look at equivalence classes of paths up to two-path equivalence, sorry. Say a pair of paths are equivalent if there's a two-path between them in C. So these two paths are very different. These are different than in this fundamental group or higher homotopy groups that Edward Check studied, but they're the same. In fact, every path here is trivial. There's only one path in this case. So this is sort of a trivial structure. It has no holes. Okay? Whereas this one is a single generating path from A to B. Well, lots of other ones could, because you could go like that as well.
So basically, if the space doesn't have any holes, then every path from every two points can be continuously formed to
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So you would say, we could say that it's fundamental group, how groupoid will be the trivial or the one point thing.
Does this hold for projective plane? I'm not sure. Because projective plane doesn't have holes.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fundamental group is two elements. You have to go twice in order to.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it doesn't hold. So, but intuitively, that's the sort of guiding idea. But you get lots of more complicated fundamental groups. Anyway, very good. So okay. So this is the intuitive idea. Formally, we look at maps out of the interval squared. So we look at the interval squared, and then so a two-path. So there's different ways of defining this, but this is standard one. Is a continuous map. It's a continuous picture of this thing. So such that, and the pic, right. So the picture is maybe best to draw a picture. So we would say A, B, and we want to have F and G. And over here we want to just be sort of constant on A, and over here constant B. So that's how we sort of think of it. So what does that say mathematically? Then you've got alpha. So along the top, you've got F, alpha, and along the bottom, G, and then along the left, you've got just constant on A, and along the right, you've got constant on B. Okay, so that's the formal definition of a two-dimensional path, but you could have equally defined it as maps out of the disk, say, or something like that. But, all right. So I should say, actually, come to these higher groupoids and higher categories, not from like this algebraic topology and stuff, or the study of spaces myself, but from, so I did a PhD in category theory, and just from considering categories, you're naturally led to study higher categories, because you've got things called natural transformations, you've got functors between categories, and then some higher cells like two-dimensional paths appear in that sort of setting. So completely independently of the motivation I'm giving you now, we're studying these structures coming from within category theory itself. There's a few different directions in which you can approach them. But okay, so now I could give you like some exercises if you want to do them. Would be given the paths F, G, and H. There's a canonical, so you can define the formula that spits out a two-path between the two possible ways of composing these things, right? So likewise, you could, the other laws that are supposed to hold in a groupoid, the other laws that are holding a groupoid, they all hold up to two-dimensional paths. Okay? So if you look at equivalence classes up to, I'm getting my mathematical when I say that sort of thing, if you look at equivalence classes of one path up to a two-path, you get a genuine groupoid. That's called the fundamental groupoid of space. But what the infinity groupoid, the higher dimensional groupoid thing is about is, what's the algebraic structure you get from space when you don't take equivalence classes of any of these things? If you look at all points, all paths, all two-dimensional paths, all three-dimensional paths, and so on, can you describe the algebraic structure of that thing in a way that actually captures a lot of information about the space? So that's what an infinity groupoid is. And now I'm just going to kind of write down slightly informal, very informal definition. Infinity groupoid C has, so things called zero cells. So these are the objects. Okay, so we might write like Bob C, or it could be just C0. Okay, so these are just the points. So then you have one cells, or these are the arrows, right? So in other words, in our sort of type theoretic notation, each pair of points has an associated set, let's say, of one cells, or arrows from x to y, and then see, also this just continues on. So then between the pair of parallel, so you only look at higher dimensional cells between things which are parallel, meaning have the same start and end point, like in a two-dimensional path. Two paths like that, or two cells. Yeah, so we could say, so in this sort of formal notation, we could say given FG of type C1XY gives rise to a set, say C2XY FG. So this is the sort of dependent type theory kind of notation where a pair of terms of a given type enable you to construct a new set or type. Okay? All right, anyway, you can draw. So I'm kind of mixed up here between a convenient sort of graphical notation and a formal set like definition in terms of types or sets or whatever, but you should probably just think of it as pictures of arrows and arrows between arrows and stuff. Then you could have three cell. This sort of notation doesn't get you very, this thing's called two groupoids and two categories. You have to stop this sort of picture if you go on to higher dimensional categories, or n categories, or n groupoids. Okay, so that's the basic data for the thing.
Sorry for interrupting. Would it make my sense to vote it the other way? I mean, under zero, for example, what does it mean for two objects to be parallel?
Well, okay, so you just say any two objects are parallel. So I can't think, so there is things like minus one. So what's the idea of minus one category? Minus one category, you can make sense of the statement that a minus one category is a partially ordered set. somewhere. Anyway, and then a minus two category is just a set. But I can't remember that. There is something you can say. So John Baez is a famous expositor about this sort of stuff. So there's various different. So there's lots of different things. In infinity groupoid, it's not a finitely axiomatizable structure, so I'm not going to be able to write down all the things that happen. You have to find a different way of defining it than just giving basic operations like composition. But it has, the intuition is that it has all these compositions, so we should be able to compose n cells together. So for example, so we have the ordinary composition of one cells or arrows, okay, but then you have things like, then you should be able to, if you've got a pair of two cells like that, then you would want to be able to get two cells like that, okay? And now, all the laws that hold in a category of groupoid, they no longer hold in one of these higher groupoids, as we saw in the example associated to space, but they hold up to up to some canonical higher dimensional cells. So I'm just going to give one example of how this gets very complicated very fast. But it's possible to get a really clever definition of an infinity groupoid in only a page or two, which it doesn't give you generating sort of operations like compositions and stuff. It encodes sort of all of the infinite number of them at once. All right. If you remember, I said that if you look at pads in space, the different ways of composing them, the associative law doesn't hold. So in that case, I said we had, so in an infinity groupoid, likewise, the laws don't hold up to equality, but only up to a higher dimensional cell. But we then have these higher dimensional cells should satisfy some equations themselves, some higher associativity law. So that in that case, what happens? This is a famous diagram I'm about to draw for you. But let me call these ones like this one here. So U, V, W, and X. All right. So then you could do something like X, W, V, U. So what are the different ways of composing them? Do that, or you could do. All of these will be connected. So I'm going to have to go through this bit just very quick. Anyway, so these are the five ways of bracketing these things. And so there's different ways of going between them. So this top one, you could do, for example, our alpha at XW, and then the X composed of W, and then VU, so like that. And then you could say go from here to here by doing alpha X, W, V dot U. And say here you could go, you could compose, so you're going to have an identity two cell on U, and then you should be able to compose that with this two cell here. I know all of this really doesn't make much sense, but I'm just trying to give a flavor of the thing, and there'll be another way going there and another way there. And now there should exist when you compose all these two cells, there should exist a three-dimensional transformation between nodes. So you'll have some alpha U, V, W, X. And then this thing will satisfy higher dimensional laws as well. So all the equalities that hold are replaced in a groupoid, say, are replaced by some higher dimensional stuff. Each equation that holds only up to higher cells, and those higher cells themselves satisfy equations that only hold up to higher dimensional cells. So the problem with defining an infinity groupoid is to make this kind of precise. So probably the most elementary definition. So I said it's hard to define. I hope I give some flavor up there. So in my opinion, so if you know a bit of category theory, like Lovier theories and stuff, in my opinion, the simplest definition is Grotendieck's. And so of course that's my opinion because I wrote a little paper about it. And if you want, it's called a Lonely Construction of Lobler or Weak Infinity Groupoids. But there's other papers about this definition as well. But you can find the references to them in there if you want to actually try and understand that precisely. And then there's another definition, or a very different one, is a different definition of infinity groupoid is called a Kahn complex. Okay. Anyway, I hope I've communicated. So now I'll do 10 quick minutes on modern loaf type theory and the idea of how you get an infinity groupoid from types. And then we'll be done. Sorry. So some of you might know quite a bit. What do I want to know about here? I'm just going to rub stuff out, so I'm not sure. So this hopefully is a little bit closer, going to be a little bit closer to functional programming, this last bit, which is what I know least about and what. In my spare moments in the last couple of weeks, I've been trying to understand this modern type theory. So it's there's a lot of research and money going in, or at least for pure mathematics in this area at the moment. There's something called homotopy type theory, which is, so the idea is that this particular type theory, which I'm just going to mention, is like a formal language for the study of spaces, or things like infinity groupoids. Infinity groupoids and spaces are supposed to be, in a certain sense, kind of the same. So we saw that intuitively every space will give rise to one of these algebraic structures called infinity groupoid by looking at all the paths and so on. And in some sense, that's supposed to identify spaces with these algebraic structures. And the sort of the formal language for this kind of study of spaces is the new idea is that it's a kind of type theory. So Martin Loeb type theory. So this is the thing I've been trying to understand a bit. So this is formal languages behind some proof assistants, which are, I guess are, so examples are Koch and Agda. I don't know if people know these things. I don't really know much about this stuff. So the thing about Martin Loeb type, right, so you've got the basic things you have are types. For example, the type of natural numbers in type theory, and you have terms or terms of types, and you have type constructors. So in Martin-Loeb type theory is a particular type theory. So in some type theories, you might only be given some types and some constructors. But so you might, for example, you have a constructor which takes a pair of types and gives you a new type, which might satisfy some sort of axiom. So all right. So the main thing about this Martin-Loeb type theory, funnily enough, was developed as a formal language for constructive mathematics. That's what Martin-Loeb intended, none of this relation to spaces. But anyway, so the main thing is there is that you allow what are called dependent types. So it's this it's a particular dependent type which is at the heart of the correspondence with infinity groupoids. So this says that given a particular type, you've got a sort of family of types associated to it. That means that so a dependent type takes one type and for each term constructs a new type dependent on it. Alright? So that's a dependent type. And so for example, I have no idea how you know this or what people know, but just an example of a dependent type then would be the one which takes, so a natural number, and you could construct, like, n tuples of natural numbers. Okay, so that's a type that's dependent on n, right? So dependent types. And so in Martin-Loeb type theory, you have things called identity types, which replace kind of equality. So there's certain identity, right? So from a pair of elements of the same type, you get a new type. And the idea that gives this sort of higher category theory or space-related interpretation is that you can think of this as the type in different ways. Type of paths from x to y, or proofs that x equals y, etc. So this is things called the identity type. So what are the? So it has some. So for each type, you're given certain rules. So the simplest rule is that if you have, or the introduction rule it's called, is that if you're given an element of anything, then you have an element of type in the identity type of xx. So this is sort of like, you could think of this as a proof. You can always prove that x is equal to x there. There's always our identity path. The other rule tells you how to work with this thing. So I'm going to state it both informally and formally, and then I'm going to briefly mention how it gives rise to the sort of structure of a higher groupoid. So it says, let me see. Suppose for each p type I x y, we have a type. We have sort of type dependent on these things, okay? And for each, and for each x of type A, a term says cx of type. So I realize this is all. I mean. What I did the last couple of weeks was largely just trying to parse this sort of this rule. Okay, so suppose you're given some dependent family of types dependent on these paths, and for each x of type A, so here we're looking at x and y of type A, you've got a term of one of the particular things when you look at the case of the reflexive path. So you've got terms for the reflexive path, but in fact that gives you a term for all the paths. So that's what, then you get a term C, which in the case you look at the reflexive path, this gives you C of X. You can write all this down in the classical notation. I don't even think I'll do it properly because I don't want to. I'm sure you'll all be getting pretty exhausted by this. So, but it says something like: suppose you've got a pair of elements and a path between them, or an element of the identity type, and you're given construction of types dependent on that. And suppose you also have something which enables you to construct an element of this. Well, then you get an element of x squared b. Anyway, this is a bit like what such that f of f of x. This is a bit more what it looks like formally. We'll see that. Yeah, go on.
Maybe you should mention that it's a form of an induction.
Yeah, so
maybe it will be a bit clearer for people.
Well, so I'll tell you what I actually understand myself of these sort of rules. So you've got introduction rules for, say, these identity, for the different dependent types. And then you've got some rules that tell you how to sort of construct maps out of this type you've just introduced. And it sort of says that if you know how to define something on the canonical elements that you're given, so in this case, the canonical elements are these reflexive things. So we were given canonical elements of the identity types like that. Then you can construct terms for all elements of the identity types. But this might be very helpful. Or sort of modern type theory, if you want to say, how do you define the product of a pair of types there? Well, it says something similar. So you've got canonical elements of a product of types, which are just an element of the first type and an element of the second. So if you want to construct sort of a map out of the product type, it's enough to define it on these canonical elements. I don't know, but maybe you could say it.
I'm not sure that I'm able to, but I would say it like when you have a mathematical induction and you prove something for base case and the successor case going from n to n plus 1, then you actually proved it for all natural numbers. So this, in a case, in a way similar, if you prove it for ref of x, which is like the canonical thing, then you prove it for everything.
Okay, so, that's it.
And in type theory, these are both elimination principles for these types. If you have a type of natural numbers, then mathematically induction actually just comes out as an elimination principle for this type. And this is the same thing for this type. But maybe I didn't make it any clearer.
I think you made it clear for me, so...
Okay.
Right. So yeah, in the natural numbers case, I guess you have this element, you have zero, and then you have the successor of each thing, and they're the canonical things. And if you know what it does on those guys, then you know how it works on everything, which is sort of what I was trying to drive out of it in that case. But right, so for a moment, I'm just going to show. Right, so you've got this, you have this rule for the identity type, which looks a bit like it could be like an equality. But what you don't have is that, for example, if there exists something in the identity type from x to y, it's not the case that x equals y. If you can add that rule, and then you get something called extensional type theory. And apparently the difference is that in this Martin loops, in version with identity types, it's type checking is decidable. But I have to admit, I don't understand myself how this special type theory is something you would sell or that would interest or really be relevant to functional programmers. But I guess these languages are based on it. But so where's my page there? I've written down a quick proof of. So how do you define the composite of... right, so suppose we have f of type I. Right, so I should say, so where is the infinity groupoid structure going to be? First of all, it's associated to each type. The objects will be the terms of that type, okay? And then for each pair of objects or terms, you have the identity type of things between them, right? So we're looking at, say, the zero cells will all be the x, y of type A, and then you have... some zero cells, and then a one cell f y to x will be an element of I a y x, so that will be something like that. And then the two cell alpha f to g is going to be an element, right? So this is now a type, and we have a pair of elements of this type, so we can form the identity type and so on. So just from the existence of this identity type, you get all these higher dimensional cells come out of it. And that's those are the points of the space. They're analogous to the points of the space, the paths, the two paths, and so on. Or proofs and proofs between proofs and all this sort of thing. So let's see if I can manage composition really, really before 8:30. So I want to compose those things. So from F of type I Y and G type I Y Z, we want an element g dot f of type AXZ. So we use this thing called an induction, basically. This is a sort of informal proof using that inductive principle. It says in the case that f is equal to this, so remember you just have to know how to construct things. In the case of the given of the reflexive path, then we have the element g type x equals, okay, so these are equal now because we've taken y equal to x. And by the induction principle, we get an element for an element g dot f type x equals is such that when f is equal to this reflexive path, we just get g. Okay, so that was sort of our given one associated to reflexive paths. And so we kind of define a function, a composition function extending that x equals az. I realize, so this is the start of chapter 2 of the homotopy type theory book, which is about, let's say, modern loaf type theory with another axiom as formal language for the study of spaces, but it's also related to people are using it for these proof assistants, Koch and Agda, and various things as well. And it's being used in the kind of for constructive mathematics purposes. Anyway, yeah, I realize that last bit was a bit unclear, but hopefully, I guess the idea is that each type via these identity types gives rise to a structure a bit like points, pads, and two pads, and so on. And that's how via these identity types, and the rules enable you to build a structure much like you can build from a space, looking at the algebra of pads they're on and so stuff like that. Anyway, so that's it.
Thank you. Okay, as a formal way to thank you, we have this like FT burner buttons. Okay. You can wear it very proudly. And yeah, thanks for everyone for coming. And yeah, I think that if you have any questions, John here will sure gladly answer them. But first, I'd like to ask you, like, because last time it turned out to be a good idea, I'm going to ask you whether someone would like to prepare a talk for the next time, so we won't have to wait like 2, 3, or 8 months for the next meetup. So if there's anyone interested in sharing something with us, but he or she. Okay, then I believe that someone will step up, and in the email he will say that, oh yeah, I will do something. Yeah, and now the informal part where we can eat all the stuff.
Hi, I have a favor to ask. If you are listening right now, please let us know by tweeting at FBBurno. That way, we'll know that recording our meetups makes sense and we'll continue to do so even though it's quite time consuming. Thanks.